So, good day. Here in Paris, it's afternoon. In other parts of the world, it's different times of day. In Australia, it's night. So it's either earlier or later than we are now, but as we know, time is relative. So it's just now, we're all here together, here, which is nowhere, except right where you are. And before, in between the sitting period and the previous sitting period and this sitting period, I did a samu period, a work period, in which I began preparing lunch because my husband is also busy today. And if I wait till after this period to start cooking, I will eat very late. And as I was doing it, I was thinking, now, why do we say that this is also practice? You know, preparing the vegetables, washing the dishes, lighting the flame under the pot. Why do we say that this is also practice? And I thought of, many of you have heard me say often to you individually or just generally, or you've heard other teachers say it, stay with it. You have a question, you have a koan, you have an issue, and I say stay with it. Be with it is another way of saying it. And sometimes I think that's probably frustrating to hear that, because you would prefer that there be some way out, or some answer, some resolution. And in fact, stay with it is the answer, is the way out, is the resolution. But we don't experience it that way, usually, when we first hear that. And if we, the Japanese, great Japanese poet, Ryotan said, something like, if you want to know the meaning, if you want to see the teaching, stop chasing after so many things. So that's the heart of this practice, is just staying here with what is. So when you're cleaning the vegetables and washing the dishes, just be doing that. Just be that. And we say this is the heart, the essence of our practice. So I was thinking about that as I was cleaning the vegetables and cooking. And I also, for the past few days, have been thinking about Diego Maradona. Okay, so everybody has heard that Diego Maradona died. And even if you don't really have any idea about Diego Maradona, you've heard that he died. And many of you are too young to have really experienced the person, the football star, playing on the field was Diego Maradona. Because this was a long time ago, you know, this was in the 80s. And so much of what you know of Diego Maradona, if you know anything, you know, it's kind of just this personality who floats around and you hear about in the news, is about everything else that he did, which was basically drugs, problems, financial issues, health problems. And so you don't really know why we were even paying attention to Diego Maradona, except you probably have heard the legends and the stories and his famous goal that he scored with his hand, and then the other goal that he dribbled the entire English team and scored, which is considered the greatest goal of all time. So you've heard the stories, you've maybe seen kind of the old grainy YouTube videos. I haven't been so much thinking about Diego Maradona as I've been thinking about the rest of us and how we're reacting to the death of Diego Maradona. And it's fascinating. And I say this because as I was doing the vegetables and I was thinking, so why is that a teaching? And then Diego Maradona comes to mind and I'm thinking, and I say, well, why is that a teaching? What is the teaching in the life and death of Diego Maradona, the legend of Diego Maradona, the public worldwide reaction to the death of Diego Maradona? As you know about me, as I often do, my teachings often come from what's happening in the world, right? I spent almost 40 years working as a journalist and am trained to pay attention. Probably 2/3 of my life as a journalist was spent as a bodhisattva journalist. So not a journalist seeking to become famous and be on television and be clever and have the latest scoop before everyone else, but as the embodiment, the bodhisattva of compassion, hearing the sounds of the world and reporting that, the sounds of the world, to the readers, because I worked for a newspaper. And this was actually great Zen training to be in that kind of work. Training because it was a training in everything he's teaching. Everything is a manifestation of the, you know, whatever, how we want to call it, the oneness of life. Everything is a manifestation, if we stay in our Zen tradition, of Mu. And so wherever I looked, as a reporter, as an editor, I saw Mu. I saw things as they are, and then would look into them and say, well, what is this? What is the teaching in this? Apart from it's Mu. And so I look into Diego Maradona's story, and a line from the poet Paul Celan came to me. He was a poet who was born in, it was before Europe was divided into the countries it is now. And, maybe Romania or no, I don't know. Anyway, he was a German speaker, but he wasn't born in Germany. And his parents died in the Holocaust, and he was able to flee and eventually took refuge in, was sent to camps and survived, and eventually took refuge in France, but continued to write in German. Even though people said, how can you write in German after the Holocaust? And there's a line from his poetry that is, speaks true who speaks shadows. So the one who speaks, so the truth is being spoken when we speak of shadows, when we include shadows in our speech. And he took that as the poet as well. You know, as a poet, he didn't only write about the luminous, the beauty, the fantastic illuminations that he might have, but he could not include shadows, because his life was one big shadow. He ended up killing himself, jumping off a bridge into the River Seine in Paris, but much later. He had a long career after the war as a poet. And so that line came to me when looking at Diego Maradona. And I'm just using this as an example because it's true of everything, but because this is such a present story. You know, Diego Maradona was this manifestation of shadow and light that is just an extreme manifestation. So he was this, his football playing defied all rules of what anyone had known before. He was a football genius. And people marveled at that. The world marveled at that. At the same time, he was like an extreme manifestation of shadows. He cheated. You know, he scored a goal with his hand. It was allowed. And afterwards, he said it was the hand of God who scored it. And this became famous. You know, it's called the hand of God goal, actually. And yet, you know, 20 minutes later, he scored this absolutely this goal that defied all rules of what you could do on the football pitch, right? And then in his life off of the pitch, off of the soccer field, it was as if he was so close to the light, so close to the perfection, and people adored him, adulated him, put him on a pedestal, and he had no protection from that. And he fell into all of the shadows and the frailties of what it is to be human. There was money, there was fame, there were all of the temptations of food, drugs, women, he exemplified everything that is human, everything that is mortal. And at the same time, he exemplified everything that we wanted to see as immortal, right? And perfect and luminous on the football field. And this was captivating. This captivates our imagination, right? And to some extent, this person represented everything we wanted to be, and yet everything on both ways. Everything he did was extreme. And I was looking earlier after we sat, these pictures behind me on my wall, and among them, there are various poets and artists who I admire and who inspire me. And most of them succumbed at a young age to many of the things that Maradona succumbed to. Many of them died young. They lived hard. But that also was why their art was so beautiful. And they lived close to danger. You know, I'm thinking of like Jean-Michel Basquiat, some of these other people, Jim Carroll, I don't know if you know who he is. You know, even Baudelaire. They held nothing back. And their life is a teaching for me in that sense, that they held nothing back. At the same time, there's a teaching in it that they also did not walk the middle way. And the middle way is, as the Buddha taught us, neither left or right, neither fast nor slow, neither good nor bad. It's dwelling. We say dwelling and non-dwelling. So the middle way is neither here nor there. So when I say, you know, there's no time, we all are on our clocks, it says a different time. But it's right now. That's the middle way, just now. When we say neither here nor there, so it's not Perth, it's not Lisbon, it's not Porto, it's not Paris, it's not Norway, it's just here, just right here. That's the middle way. And this middle way, to stay there, to dwell in the middle way, is extremely difficult. Or at least we think it's difficult because we're so used to going there or here, or being fast or slow. The American poet Gertrude Stein said, when you get there, you see there's no there there. Critics, literary critics, have misunderstood this, and they think she's talking about her hometown of Oakland, California, and that she was saying it's such a horrible place, boring. When you get there, you realize there's nothing there. But that's not what she was saying. She was saying what we're saying. When you get there, you see there's no there there. There is no there to be. It's here. And when you get here, you see there's no here here. You don't actually get there either. You are there. You are it. So Maradona's life was spent not on that middle way. And he took it to great extremes. Extremes that none of the rest of us, most of us, don't go to, right? So we have this popular saying, burning the candle at both ends. So when you burn the candle at both ends, eventually it burns out, you know, and very quickly. So, you know, if we look at Maradona, his life is a teaching, and the reaction that we've seen worldwide is a teaching. Even the fact that I doubt there's anyone here who hasn't heard about him having died. Possibly, but I doubt it. Even if you don't really know who he is, even that fact shows that he speaks to the multitudes. And what does he say? Unfortunately, well, maybe it's not unfortunate. To a great extent, he's appealing to our craving, our desire, our desire to defy limits. Maradona seemed to, if you followed him at all, and I did as a journalist, he seemed constantly to defy the limits of being human. He always escaped from his various traps that he was walking into himself, right? And so it's almost stunning that suddenly he dies. He's human, after all. And I think part of the reaction is that it's kind of this sideration, this surprise, this extraordinary thing. Maradona died. And in just a very human way. You know, he didn't go out in flames in a car crash, which a lot of heroes do, you know, or jump off a bridge into the river, or it's just very ordinary thing. We're not even sure exactly what, but it was just ordinary. And it's a teaching in, yes, there are limits. As humans, we are mortal. We are impermanent. We will die. And Maradona too. Of course, people are saying, I forget which way it goes, but it's, you know, Diego died, but Maradona will never die. People are saying things like that. The legend, there's a certain nostalgia. And we can see that in much of what we experience, not around Maradona, but in when we experience loss, grief, death. It can be loss of our own youth. You know, people my age, I'm the same age as Maradona. So people my age, we see it and we're like, wow, yeah. We were 20 years old when he did that, you know? When he won the World Cup, you know, yeah, we were in the prime of our life too. And so there's a certain bittersweetness to that too. It's like our youth is gone with Maradona. I'm not saying me personally, but I think a lot of people of my generation. And yet we can see that in just, you know, a flower that is in a vase on our desk. The same kind of wistfulness we can have. The flower's fading. The flower's gone. Or during this pandemic of our, what we call our way of life. We're nostalgic for our way of life and being able to be with people without masks, being able to hug people, touch people, share meals together. Or we might feel wistful with our way of life, our freedom of just being able to go and do what we want to do, when we want to do it, where we want to do it. Those are manifestations of not resting here in the middle way. Just being with what is, seeing what is, experiencing what is as the teaching. And so I can say the teaching with, you know, a big T. Everything, all of this is a manifestation of the whole of life. Each breath, each speck of dust, each step you take, the whole of life is manifest there in that. That was the Buddha's fundamental teaching. You know, he famously, according to whatever tradition you follow or translation, he said something to the effect of, at this instant, all me and all sentient beings throughout space and time are awakened simultaneously. My awakening is your awakening. So this weekend, we're celebrating the Buddha's awakening, but it's our awakening. We just have to pay attention You know, be the bodhisattva of compassion. Pay attention and experience it by not looking for so many other things. That's why we just say, just sit here on your cushion right now. And it's almost like we're putting ourselves in a box and saying, sit here, just do this, so that we can awaken to that all beings throughout space and time, including me, are awake right now. But often we get caught in moving away from the middle way, because the middle way is frightening to not have reference points, to not have positions, to not project what we want, how we want things to be, or how we don't want them to be. So either grasping them, wanting, or pushing away, rejecting. And we spend so much time and effort doing that, and that only serves to feed our dissatisfaction, feed our unhappiness, feed our frustration, feed our desire for more. And Maradona is sadly an example of that. It was never enough. And tragically, he tried really hard over and over again. You know, he went into detox, and he even had, this operation on your stomach where you reduce the size of your stomach so that he wouldn't eat so much. He tried, but he was human, and he failed. We can say he failed. At the same time, he was manifesting the whole of life. He was manifesting the shadows of life. And it's a teaching for us, as I said, to see that the more we feed it, the more we want. So it's a tricky request that we're making of ourselves to stay in the middle way, to not give in to those, well, let's say, to not wander off to the right or the left, to the good or the bad, to the light or the shadow, to just stay in the middle way. And actually, the middle way encompasses both of the sides. That's why I cite this quote from Paul Celan. Speaks true who speaks shadows. That's part of the middle way. So we stay with the shadows and we stay with the light, but we don't settle on either one. And we don't seek one or the other. We embrace all. And in our daily lives, we have every moment is an opportunity to do that. Something that I cite from Joyce's Ulysses often is when one of the main characters, Stephen Dedalus, who's a teacher in a boys' school, is having some kind of philosophical discussion with the headmaster of the school, while the boys are outside playing during the break. And some discussion about God. And so the teacher, the headmaster, finally says to Stephen Dedalus, well, what is God? What is his idea of God? What is God then? And at this moment, the boys are playing football, oddly enough, football outside. And Stephen says, a shout in the street. The boys are playing football. One of the boys shouts. At that moment, the teacher says, what is God? And Stephen says, a shout in the street. Great Zen practitioner, Stephen Dedalus, gave a direct response, gave a direct manifestation of the koan. What is God? Can we see, you know, with someone yesterday, I was discussing this, that in the traditional original teachings in Islam and Judaism, you're not allowed to, in Judaism, you can't say the name of God. It's that which has no name, or he who has no name, or something like that. And in Islam, you cannot represent it. You can't represent God. So this has been interpreted as you cannot have show an image of God. And it's become a, you know, as we've seen the consequences of, if you represent an image of the prophet, this is a grave sin in Islam. And we've seen the consequences of that, right? But it can't be represented, God. You know, I think if we go back to the original teachings, that it's the same experience that we would talk about, that it can't be represented, it can't be named. It's a shout in the street. It can't be, as soon as you fix it in one image, it's no longer that. On the middle way, everything is it. And as soon as you say one thing is it, then you're no longer in the middle way. So if, you know, we can see another teaching in Maradona that as soon as we label him, a devil, we miss what's divine in him. And this is true for all of us. So, and this I think is part of the appeal to people, is the genius and the bad boy of Maradona, you know, that it's impossible to put him in one place or the other. It's impossible to put any of us in one place or the other. Because we all embody the shadow and the light. We would like to only embody the light. And yet, part of embodying the light means embodying the shadow. That's the middle way. That's our practice. So when we sit, that all of this is implicit in our practice. We just sit with whatever is. We try not to judge whether it's good or bad. We try not to hang on to the things we like and push away the things we don't like. Our aspiration is to hold it all. Just in this moment. So we're not saying in the next moment. Just right now, just when you're sitting. And as we all observe, our minds are coming and going all the time and chattering about all kinds of things. And maybe you have observed that, so let's say you start your sitting period with that aspiration, and you say, okay, I'm just going to sit here with this, and you might focus on your breath or whatever it is your technique is, and then your mind starts to wander. And sometimes you will go with it. You'll follow it and start going off and planning what you will do for your summer holiday, or how terrible it is that you can't see your mother, or how good it is that you can't see your mother, or any number of things. The shoes that you want to buy online, the last retreat you did, how annoying Zoom is, whatever, you know, and you get caught up in it all. And this is, so we're you're moving away from the middle. And then when you become aware of it, oh, yeah, I'm going off on this thing about Zoom and how I don't like it, and how I would like something else. And then, well, yeah, that other retreat we did, or yeah, when I take the airplane, this happens, or I can't take an airplane anymore, or you know, whatever. Then you just come, when you realize that, you just come back. And then for that second, then, you are embodying the middle way. And very quickly, you might then start judging yourself and saying, that was bad. Why was I drifting? I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. This is so annoying. And then you're off again. And so the challenge is to then come back again and again and again and again without indulging in these wanting, not wanting, here and there, good and bad, right and left, whatever, exciting, boring. And the more you do that, you know, I say that my practice as a journalist was a good training, because as a journalist, we are asked to just report the facts. We're not, and this is a certain kind of journalism, we are not asked to give opinions or judge. We are just asked to report the facts, which is, you know, a tough thing to do, because as humans we naturally judge, and by just what we're choosing to report we're making a judgment, right? But that is that's the goal, just to observe and report. Observe, report. And I think probably part of my surprise now about the reaction to Diego Maradona comes from the fact that for most of my life as a journalist, I wasn't focusing on Maradona as being good or bad. I was just reporting Maradona. And was surprised to see how much people had invested in Maradona, in fact. And I would say my bodhisattva route as practice as a journalist began when I started doing my Zen practice and had a really life-changing encounter with the Dalai Lama, which some of you have heard before. I've told this story before. I was a very young practitioner, pretty young journalist, but experienced enough that my newspaper trusted me with going to interview the Dalai Lama when he was visiting Paris once. And so I went, I prepared in advance. I was new to the Zen practice, and so I didn't know a lot. So I asked my teacher what she thought I should ask, and other people. I asked, of course, my editors what they wanted me to ask, how they wanted me to approach it. And everyone had their angle. The editors, of course, wanted the Tibet-China angle, you know, the geopolitical angle. My Zen teacher gave me the Buddhist angle. Someone else said to me, oh, you know, ask him what he does with anger, because his issue was anger. And, you know, everybody had these things they wanted. So I prepared, I read his biography, I read some of his teachings, and went for the day for the interview. And I only had a half an hour. And it was media day, so in this fancy hotel in Paris. And so every half hour, there was a different journalist who went in. So when my turn came, they came and got me. And I went in to this room, this beautiful suite in this hotel. And there was the Dalai Lama and all of these men like, you know, the Tibetan government in exile, translators, probably important lamas who I didn't know anything about. You know, there were probably at least 10 people in there, and me and the Dalai Lama. So they present me to the Dalai Lama, you know, and we bow. And so I introduce myself and hadn't really thought about that part. I hadn't prepared for that part, actually. I guess I just forgot. And so I found myself saying things that I hadn't planned to say because I hadn't planned anything. I told him the newspaper I was from, and he immediately reacted positively. He loved it. He read that newspaper every single day, wherever he was in the world. It's an international newspaper, and which is a very prestigious newspaper. And that helped me, you know, felt warm. And then I heard myself start saying, well, you know, I'm a Zen practitioner and I'm coming here to serve as a conduit, as a bridge between you and my readers. I'm bringing what little I know about Buddhism and my experience of the worldly world as a journalist to it, so that I can talk to you and ask questions from a perspective of a journalist who knows that worldly world, but also with some sensibility of Buddhism. And I will bring back the answers to my readers, having this sensitivity of Buddhism, but also how I can express your answers so they will understand them. Like I said, I had not planned this. I had no idea that I was even thinking this, but I think that it's the experience, the meeting with him and his presence suddenly awakened the bodhisattva journalist in me. Probably somewhere this had been going on in my head, but I wasn't aware of it. And that experience changed my life, changed my whole entire career as a journalist. I never worked as a journalist in the same way again. It was as if I had awakened to the oneness of life in that context, and what it meant to not be attached to my identity, either as a Zen practitioner or as a journalist, or even to an identity of me. I was a tube. You know, I was just a tube through which this information was passing in two ways, in two directions, you know, two-way traffic. And this helped me greatly to how I observed as a journalist what was happening in the world, and also how I presented it to my readers. And it also enhanced greatly my Zen practice because everything became a teaching, right? So my Zen practice was not limited to just sitting in the Zendo, chanting sutras and eating an orioki, or putting on a robe. In that time, we wore robes. It was everything. So the tube was going both ways there too, between my Zen practice and my everyday life, which brought me to you, which is, you know, life is practice and practice is life. The middle way is that. In the middle way is practice and life. Life is practice and practice is life. So all of this to say, as I was doing my cooking this morning, and I was thinking what I would say to you, and I was thinking that's what I would say to you, that just look closer, sometimes I say to you, look closer. Look so close that there's no separation. The teaching is you, you know. My teacher gave me that Dharma name, Tu es cela. You are it. You are that. So look closer. This, it's not just that, okay, I'm going to focus on cutting the carrots and turning on the flame and washing the pot. It's that that actually is the teaching. That is it. There's nothing else that you need to look for in this moment. So I can, you know, open the newspaper and Diego Maradona is a teaching. The pandemic is a teaching. Look out my window. The guy walking past my window in the street is a teaching. The clutter on my desk is a teaching. Your faces in these rectangles, which are, wow, so diverse. The absolute unlimited diversity of what appears on my screen at this moment is just, that's a teaching. And that's what the Bodhisattva of compassion means too, is listen to it all, hear it. And, you know, as we know from Bernie Glassman's teachings of hearing it without an idea of what it is you're hearing, just receive it. Because you don't have an idea about what it is, you can just receive it. You can just bear witness to it. And then the action arises naturally. Whatever arises from that is appropriate, is the middle way. So I think I'll stop there and offer you the possibility to say something or ask questions to add to this unbelievably diverse visual that we have. It would be nice to hear some other sounds, other voices.
Can I start?
Yes, Shuang, yes.
So, good morning. First of all, thank you very much. For this talk, it touched me deeply. And I think it was this thing of really encompassing and includes the shadows. And so I was touched because I'm struggling with my shadows too. And I was thinking also that how it can be easy with the difficulty of being in the middle way, to feel bad about failing, about indulging in shadows and all that, and how liberating it is to hear you and to go back to the humanness and this angle that really can support us and accept us and re-put us on the light of what is and accepting it. So thank you very much for that. And I was also associating with a comedian, a Portuguese comedian, that does a lot of improvisation. And his name is César Mourão. And the Portuguese people know who is him for sure. And I never forget, in one show, the interviewer was asking him what was the secret for him to be able to improvise so good, so well. And he just said in an unpretentious way, and that really passed on, not paying attention to what he said, but I just got it. And he was saying that, it's really to listen to the people. So and then he continued talking about every other thing. But and I think it is so true. And what everything you were talking about, it was, and you were at the end talking about that listening. And how the right action comes from listening. And I made the association with him, and because I'm also doing spontaneous theater, improvising theater, and so it touched me also personally in this work of me. So yeah, I just want to share this with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Shwam. Yeah, it's very true. When you any kind of improv or imitations, you have to really empty yourself of yourself, otherwise you can't do it. You know, you become caught by yourself. That's true. That's a good metaphor too for life. I think Tomas had his hand up.
Thank you, Roshi. Good to be here and see everyone. So just sharing a little experience that I had this morning that for me it resonates with what you've been saying, particularly with this being in retreat and being out of retreat as the middle way and trying to embrace both. So I totally forgot about the retreat. And I this morning there was the follow-up email mentioning the recording of yesterday. I said, oh, good, retreat. And I was washing dishes when I saw that in my iPhone. And then for me it was, okay, there was no guilt or trying to, I wish I could have done better. Just this came to me, how can I make this retreat as well? So the fact that I miss retreat is also retreat. My son is throwing things at me. Okay, just a second. See, Mari. So, and so for me, because my retreat is this and it's all the time, it helped me. This failure, it helped me to embrace outside retreat as retreat, if this makes any sense to me. But that's something very simple, as just not much conflict and guilt, and just I do what I can, which is what I was always intending to do. So I guess forgetting that retreat was starting, it's also part of it, and including that, and the being here in my non-stopping, ever-continuing, endless retreat of parenting. So I just wanted to share that because for me it all that's the middle way that I'm treading at the moment. That's my path at the moment. It's bringing these two things together. Otherwise, there's no practice. There is just conflict. It's the life outside form of practice, the life inside form of practice. And if I don't make it one, if I don't allow it to be one, there's no practice. So just wanting to share that.
Thank you, Thomas. That's direct experience for all of us of practice. Life is practice. And in the same way as Joao said, you know, about not feeling guilty about indulging in the shadows, that too is practice, you know, that it's all practice. And I'm really happy to hear both of you saying it, because that's it, you know. I feel like, yeah, they got it. So thank you. Christine?
Yeah. Hello, everyone. I just want to add some little thing that came to my mind when you said that the craving also comes from the more, or I don't remember exactly how you said it, but when you talked about Diego Maradona, that the more we indulge in it, the more we want, in something like that. And yeah, it just made me think of sugar, the drug sugar. The more you eat, the more you want. It's a little bit like that it works. And I really can observe that with my children, because I really try to limit sugar. And yeah, the less they eat, the less they want. It works in the other way too, you know. Yeah, we kind of stopped eating sugar during week at special opportunities, or sometimes I say yes, but now as we have really reduced that they eat sugar, they hardly ask for it anymore. But if you give them each day sugar, they ask for sugar every day, because they always think of, oh, can I have a little sweetie? And I'm not very attracted by sugar, so I really see that it's easy for me to not eat sugar. But as a child, I ate a lot, and we did 7 weeks without around Easter. You know, there was a tradition of feasting, or so you say. And in my family, we did that we did 7 weeks without watching television, or 7 weeks without sugar, or things like that. And I always, as a child, I observed how sweet chocolate was after these 7 weeks of not eating sugar, that it was almost, it was too much. It didn't taste good anymore, because I had lost this taste of sugar. And then you become more sensitive to the sugar. So yeah, that just came to my mind, because it's probably the same for drugs. The problem is, once you indulge in it, the more it's an addiction. So yeah, it makes you want more of it.
Yeah. Thank you. Also, good illustration that we can see our fundamental addiction is to ourselves, and that the more that we indulge in that, our attachments and our desires and our wanting and not wanting and our opinions and our ideas and everything, the more we focus on that.
Yeah.
And our whole practice is to unlearn, to train to not do that, to break that habit.
Yeah.
And the more that we do, it's like with sugar, the less that we want to do that.
Yeah. And what's interesting about that too, I don't remember, I heard a conference lately, and I think it has even been shown scientifically that when you meditate, that there are different brain areas, and they can identify the brain area that is firing when you are thinking about yourself or indulging in the self, or when it's oriented towards others, you know, the compassion. And apparently they can distinguish the brain areas, and when you meditate, there is a tendency to shut down the me area and to go into the all is one area, the other area, something like that. I understood it like that. I don't have read or watched up the science behind, but I found that quite interesting. Yeah, it was definitely as somebody who was working with neurosciences or something like that. I found that interesting. Yeah, because that's what we observe within the practice, what's happened. So
Exactly.
Yeah.
Lisa?
Good afternoon already, here anyway. It's funny, when you speak of the middle way, one would, what comes up at first is how boring. How boring, because, well, if you look at Maradona or all the artists that you were mentioning, well, you can think this is a full life because they've done things and they've gone to extremes. And so what's left in the middle way? It's just boring. But at the same time, it's ignoring not seeing the strength of that just now and how full it is. But yeah, it's just how do you there? Yeah, it's just how's the question I want to put is. Yeah, what do you answer to this idea that that people might throw back at you actually about the middle way? It's just, oh, but it's always compromise. It's not this. It's not opinion. So it's not this nor that. So it's just neutral, and neutral is boring.
Well, I think I don't know in what situation people would ask me that. However, the notion of boredom is part of the relative world. So something is boring or it's exciting. So it's to return to the dualities if we say it's boring or it's exciting, as is neutral, because the middle way is not neutral. And that's where it's tricky, that it can only be experienced. And as you said at the beginning, that because it encompasses everything, it's full. It's what, you know, in traditional teachings we call empty, but actually my own experience is fullness. And you said it too. It's full because it's everything. Nothing is excluded. So in a sense, we could say that's where the pure excitement is, or the total excitement, or the total boredom is. But because it's total, there is nothing outside, there's nothing boring, because as soon as you set up boring, you set up exciting. So I think it can't really be communicated verbally in that sense. When the Buddha was asked questions about duality like that, he didn't answer. And that's maybe the best answer. I think probably everyone, whether they practice or not, has had some kind of experience of the middle way. We have that experience regularly, in fact, but we don't pay any attention to it. When we are just completely present with something, when we feel a real joy that's not attached to something, when we can just be present with someone in a very ordinary way. I think it's a common human experience, actually, but we become quickly, we don't pay attention to it, I think, because at a very young age, we are trained to do something else. You know, like Christine says, at a very young age, we get sugar. And so that takes us away from just this ordinary experience and tries to add something heightened to it. And then when we feel sadness, people tell us, oh, it's nothing. That's what we say to children when they fall down. It's nothing, it's nothing. In French, we say, c'est rien, c'est rien, c'est rien. So we're not encouraged to experience things as they are. and therefore we look for them to be some other way.
And even worse, when kids fall and hurt themselves, you give them candies to not feel the hurt.
Exactly.
So, yeah. And the c'est rien, I heard it so often on the playground when I picked up my children. I mean, kids fall all the time when they are climbing up things and whatever, and or just running, and they fall all the time. But it's not nothing.
Right.
It's not nothing. In that moment, they feel pain. So as a parent or the person who cares for the child, it's we serve them much better when we just acknowledge what is. Just see, yeah, it hurts. And in any case, it passes so quickly that 2 minutes later, the child is laughing again. But it's rather on the contrary when the adult denies the pain, that the child keeps whining because it just wants recognition of what it's experiencing.
Exactly.
And that's really what you can observe so often, that which would be so easy, but I too had to learn that in my parenting journey. Maybe that was one of the things I did quite from the start, to acknowledge pain. But I observe that it's not every parent and adult does that with children. It's very common that the real feeling of the child is denied.
Because we're denying our own pain. We don't
yes.
want to feel our own pain. So
yes, of course. And we only want the bright side and not the shadows.
Exactly.
So.
And yet when we look at what all of this adulation for Diego Maradona, it's almost like an unconscious desire to hold both sides, because he's such an extreme shadow and such an extreme light that it's interesting that people would absolutely adore this and venerate this person who encompasses both to such extremes. I think Jose Eduardo raised his hand, but then we have to stop after him. Sorry.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you very much, Emmy, for your very nice and inspired talk on Diego Maradona. Actually, while you were speaking, I was also having my thoughts. And the interesting thing is that if you realize the example you gave, it's just Diego Maradona got this, I mean, almost godly dimension, because he was participating in one of these activities. I guess with all sports is like this, which is very dualistic. I mean, the famous goal with the hand, with the God's hand, of course, it was fantastic for the Argentinian people, but very, very frustrating. I think it was they were playing with the English team, I think. So it's so interesting to see that the happiness or the realization is of something is very much connected with the frustration of something that is not done or that causes an happiness in other people. So this is only to say as a comment upon what you were just saying, and realizing that in the end this always brings back to this very fundamental teaching that we cannot separate anything. We cannot separate the, let's say, enlightened dimension of life from the samsaric part of life. Everything comes together, perhaps, and this we cannot. Perhaps oneness is a feeling. Sometimes it's a realization, but it cannot be separated from our dualistic dimension of life. So maybe this is a little bit intellectual what I'm saying, but it's so interesting to realize that Diego Maradona is of course seen especially by the Argentinian people as a god, but and of course everyone acknowledges him as a great football player, but his shadow side is let's say is more shadow side is also encompassing the unhappiness that he brought to the English people when they were defeated. I had my own experience when Portugal won France. I think the whole Portuguese that saw that game 4 years ago or so. I realized that that my personal happiness of winning that game as a Portuguese, of course, was complemented by the sadness of the French people. But I could not escape my own happiness. let's say that is part of the game as well. That is so difficult to separate both sides in everything that we do. I don't know if the enlightened experience is also the realization of all this darkness. So, okay, this is just a comment. And it's also, just by the way, it's also interesting that if we saw these images on TV about the funeral of Maradona, I mean, his life, actually, his death in this case, goes on bringing a lot of confusion. If you see all these people together and if you see the circumstances in which this is happening with the coronavirus and people getting together, and so it's obviously that man was a special man. He drives a lot of energy, and is the embodying of a great energy, is obviously. And we cannot also, just to end it, we cannot also, this is another thing, we cannot also dissociate that from the fact that religion nowadays is really religion. Football is really a religion. It's something that perhaps also should take into consideration how this more, unconscious spiritual dimension of football is activated with this kind of stories, with Maradona, with the team that we are supporters and that loses. So all the dualistic dimension of life is ever present. Okay, this is just my comment on what you said.
Thank you.
I'm
sorry we are out of time. We will be back in a few hours to sit again. And I think you received the email. You can sign up for interviews as well, you know, which will start this afternoon with Joa giving interviews. So, bon appétit, as we say in French, in Portuguese as well. See you later. Thank you.